This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. When we talk about what institutional racism looks like, it's generally explained in tangible and intangible ways that aren't codified in law. Well, not anymore, at least. When I looked at the original deed to my first home, a 1950s Cape Cod-style house in Ann Arbor that flew up with others just like it after the war, I was horrified to see that it was written right there in plain language that the home was never to be sold to a Black family. That's no longer enforceable by law, but it's a grave reminder that what's often unspoken segregation now was made explicit just a few decades ago. Bridge Detroit recently wrote about local-level housing segregation in a piece titled "Detroit Suburbs Grapple with the History of Being Anti-Black Sundown Towns." Bryce Huffman was the reporter on that story and a former Michigan radio reporter. Welcome back to Stateside, Bryce.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
So let's talk about what a sundown town is. Explain that term.
Yeah, so a sundown town, generally speaking, is just a municipality where after sundown, Black people were not allowed to be there. The reason that it's after sundown is because many of these towns let Black people work there, mostly in service roles, being housemaids, being butlers, things like that for rich people, but they weren't allowed to own homes there. So the implication was if they were there after sundown, that means they probably lived there. So these towns sometimes chased Black people out, sometimes had law enforcement simply escort them out. But a lot of times people were forced out either with violence or with the threat of violence.
Was it made explicit in law, or was it something that was enforced sort of off the books?
In certain suburbs, it was actually part of law. And the way that they did this wasn't the same in every suburb. Some suburbs had laws on the books saying that if a Black person was across their border after dark, law enforcement was not going to protect that person. So any trouble that came their way, they would have to deal with alone. Other suburbs had it in housing contracts and in neighborhood association contracts where they weren't allowing Black people to live there or own homes there, even though at the time, especially after World War II, a lot of Black families could actually afford to own homes in these neighborhoods.
Right. So not dissimilar to what I saw on my deed that would have just been very common.
That was average, you know. Yeah. That was very normal to have housing deeds, and people still buy homes to this day, where in the deed it says you're not allowed to sell to a Black person. I actually have cousins in Detroit who on the east side of Detroit had a home where that was part of the deed. It was they're not allowed to sell this home to Black people, and obviously a lot of people who would go on to buy and then resell these homes didn't pay any attention to that. That was definitely something that was in writing.
So when did these series of policy maneuvers become unenforceable? I imagine it was sort of a game of inches as well, making these unenforceable by law.
Yeah. So what we really started to see was in the 70s, a lot of these rules were no longer kind of on the books per se. They were just part of the public perception, right? So a place like Livonia didn't have any laws on the books restricting Black people from living there after, you know, the 60s and 70s, but people knew the reputation. People avoided it because of the reputation. And white homeowners there often subtly and sometimes not so subtly tried to enforce it on their own.
You reference in your story a researcher who listed all of Michigan's sundown towns that he could find, and they're all over the map in Michigan. Kalamazoo, East Lansing, Birmingham, Bad Axe, I mean, just throughout the entire state. But it's really not that hard to notice that many of them are concentrated around the city of Detroit itself. How did the relationship get this way explicitly in Southeast Michigan?
Yeah, that is actually a really good point. A lot of the places that had the strict rules were concentrated in Metro Detroit because as is still the case, many of the state's African American population is centered in Metro Detroit. So the reason that a lot of them wanted to have rules on the books was because they wanted to stay all white. And with the city of Detroit having factories and places where black people were working and earning money, to them, the threat of having black people invade their neighborhoods was a lot realer than in other parts of the state, where there weren't a high concentration of black people working and living there.
You talk about Livonia in your story because of a controversial billboard that went up recently. Tell us a little bit more about it.
So the billboard says, "Driving while black, racial profiling ahead, welcome to Livonia." And when I first saw it, I thought, wow, people in Livonia probably won't be too happy to see that. So I think what this billboard is really trying to get people to wake up to is that implicit bias and racial profiling still exist. These are not things that are new, but these are things that we need to reckon with, especially if you are in Livonia and you want your neighborhood to be more diverse, or if you think diversity matters for your neighborhood and community. These are discussions that need to be had. So when the group put up the billboard, that was their full intention, was to have the conversation that a lot of people might not be ready to have.
Yeah, sundown towns, you know, that's a phrase that I did not grow up with and wasn't familiar with me in my white family. And that's not something we ever really discussed or I had any knowledge of until I started working with my former colleague and your current editor, Stephen Henderson. And in discussions with him, that's the first time I ever really remember hearing about this idea that you couldn't be somewhere after sundown. When you're talking with family and friends and sources today, and your story has a lot of historical context, but when you're talking today, are there still communities that folks feel like they should not be in or around after sundown? And what would be that perceived threat if not the police escorting people out anymore?
I think what happens nowadays is we as black kids and teenagers, we're getting to a point where we're exploring more of the area around us. You know, we're starting to drive, we're starting to hang out with friends who might not live so close to us or in our neighborhoods, and family members who remember what it was like when they literally weren't allowed in these places after dark. They want to warn us. They want to keep us safe. So when we hear stories about, you know, police in other communities pulling over black drivers and shooting them for minor traffic offenses, our family members and our elders and people who know the history here, they want to prevent us from being another headline. So a lot of the time, the conversations when you're driving for the first time, when you're 16 and you get your license, you know, for a lot of kids I went to high school with, the conversation was as simple as, you know, make sure you wear your seatbelt and don't have too many friends in the car. For me and my black friends, it was, you know, really be careful when you cross 8 Mile because the cops might not be as friendly as the ones here in Detroit.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Bryce Huffman. He's a reporter at Bridge Detroit. You may, however, know him from his days as a West Michigan reporter here on Michigan Radio and the host of Same, Same, Different podcast. I want to talk a little bit more about housing again with you, Bryce, and how that plays into the sundown town aspect of how we view community. Let's talk about access to capital specifically and how the lending system and the deeds that were on homes shaped where people could live in any of these communities we're talking about.
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up because I think that is a piece of the segregation, not only in Michigan or not even in Metro Detroit, but around the country that people don't really talk about much. The Federal Housing Administration really did commit a sin that they haven't ever reckoned with when it comes to segregation. The lending policies themselves were actually just plain racist. They made mortgage loans that were affordable, available to white people, and they could buy homes in these newly started up suburbs, while black families were almost entirely excluded from that opportunity. And this occurred even in times when black people could afford to pay double what their white counterparts could. And then, of course, we all know about the practice of redlining, which excluded certain neighborhoods from not just loans, but from government assistance and from federal programs that would help these neighborhoods do better in the decades to come. So when we look at just, you know, the loan practice alone, we see that Black people weren't allowed to build up capital the same way as white Americans. And when people ask me now, you know, Bryce, why is it that all these major cities in every part of the country seem to have a similar trend when it comes to poor Black people living in rundown, rough neighborhoods? You know, I tell them the same thing. It's these neighborhoods were deemed not important by the federal government and therefore didn't receive the money that it would have taken to keep these neighborhoods afloat and prospering the way the government supported white communities.
We've seen reports even in recent years that the bulk of mortgage loans are going in the city of Detroit, which is a majority Black city, going to majority white homeowners. And I'm just curious what we know about the ability for Black people to access capital today and how that affects that sundown town dynamic in Southeast Michigan.
So I think when we talk specifically about Southeast Michigan and Metro Detroit, the suburbs around the city, a lot of them were built up around the city in a way that they wanted to be all white to begin with. So people knew when they would apply for these loans and when they would build houses and when they would buy houses, they knew that the value of their neighborhood was going to stay up the whiter it was. And that's not an accident. You know, I think for Detroit, when we look at home ownership and the poverty rate, they go hand in hand. We can't separate the segregation aspect, the lending practices, redlining. We can't separate any of that from people wanting to be separate from what they perceived was a Black city that had danger and crime and all of these problems that they wanted to be no longer associated with. And that's why Metro Detroit looks the way that it does nowadays.
What is the pretense on which communities can justify or operate around with these kind of sundown stances in a modern America?
I think a lot of it is they dress up the language. They don't want to say they're against having Black people move in because that would immediately become a lawsuit and become a terrible headline. What they say is they want people in their community who can afford to live there, who come from good homes already a lot of the time, and they want to talk about crime a lot of the time. And when you look at a city like Detroit that is majority Black, that has a high poverty rate, that is often negatively depicted because of crime, it gives people this false sense that Black communities and Black people are more likely to be criminal in nature or more dangerous in nature. And, you know, yes, when you look at crime stats, that's part of it. But it's also you have to think about how these neighborhoods have been policed and how police forces often don't treat white criminals and Black criminals the exact same way. So nowadays, when suburbs and different municipalities talk about, well, you know, yeah, we're majority white, but that's not really our fault. And that's not because of racism. It's because of, you know, this factor, that factor, and this other factor. What they're really trying to do is pass the blame down to other factors that, you know, might be partially true, but, you know, these municipalities, they know what goes on. They understand that people in their neighborhoods respond negatively when Black people move in. They respond negatively when Latino families move in next door. I was hearing stories from people who didn't want to go on record, but were telling me all sorts of horror stories about having the police called on them while they're walking their dogs in these suburbs. The police called on them when they're picking their kids up from school. And a lot of it comes down to simply, you know, racism, old-fashioned, nothing new about it, all-American racism.
So that kind of gets to the heart of the phenomenon of like a self-segregation and why people, why a Black person might decide to live in a Black community because they don't want to have to have the police called on them while they're walking their dog. But we started the story with a woman in Livonia, a Black woman in Livonia that you interviewed. Did you talk to her about why she chooses to stay in that community despite the circumstances around her or the lack of other Black and brown people who live near her?
Yeah, I talked to her. Her name is Delisha Upshaw, and she has lived in Livonia, I think, for maybe the past 15 or so years. And she said she moved out there for the same reason a lot of people move out there, schools. Detroit has a very troubled history with its public school district. It is continually defunded year after year after year, and that goes to show you that some people will put their child's education over their own safety and comfort. And I think that's the choice a lot of Black people in Metro Detroit make. They want to have their kid have the best opportunity for their future. And, you know, sometimes they recognize that sending their kid to a Detroit public school might not be that best option for them.
Do you get the impression that sundown towns, though they have a very steeped history in the area, are going the way of the dinosaur, that they are at least phasing themselves out? Or do you think that they will find a way to exist in some way, whether it's changing the way that it's enforced or not?
I think now it's not a necessarily a quote-unquote sundown town. I think what we have is suburbs who have this perception that's so deep that it will never really go away. And part of it isn't just the perception, it's also the economic reality that, you know, if a suburb is very expensive to live in, thanks to how economics and race are tied up in this country and generating wealth happened in this country, you're already blocking yourself off to having a lot of Black people live there. And I think that is how sundown towns, or these former sundown towns, are going to remain. I don't think the Grosse Pointes will ever be majority Black. I don't think Livonia will ever be majority Black. And I don't necessarily think that that's a horrible thing. I just think that we need to recognize why it won't be that way. And we need to recognize that the people who are living there and benefiting from not having to pay as high property taxes and having better schools and having what a lot of people think are safer communities, a lot of that comes down to race.
Bryce Huffman authored a piece entitled Detroit Suburbs Grapple with the History of Being Anti-Black Sundown Towns. That piece was published in Bridge Detroit, where he is a reporter. Thanks so much, Bryce.
Thanks for having me, Laura.